This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the incomparable Linda Barry. Her Ernie Pooks comic strip ran in alt weeklies around the country for almost 30 years. She's just republished some of her work in Blabber, 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 Volume 1, which is supposed to reach Volume 10, if you can believe that. She's come out with two other cool books in the last couple of years. Picture This, which actually I haven't read, embarrassed to say, but one that I just read, What It Is, an incredible book about, well, it's part memoir and part a creativity lesson, her many creativity lessons. These days she gives seminars on creativity or clinics, whatever you want to call them. She's currently doing so at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Linda Barry, welcome to Progressive Radio.
I'm delighted to be here.
I think a lot of our listeners know you as the author of that comic strip. You gave it up. Why?
Well, I did the comic strip once a week for 30 years, and it ran in alternative papers. And as alternative papers started to disappear or be swallowed up by basically three different companies, they got rid of the weirder stuff, and I really qualify as the weirder stuff because my comic strip sometimes is really sad. And all of a sudden they'd have meetings and go, why do we want a sad comic strip again in the paper? So the job sort of disappeared. And then I started to get interested in another aspect of going deeper into this kind of work that I'm very interested in. So I stopped.
Do you miss doing it?
I do miss doing it because it turns out that the only way I can see those characters is if I'm drawing them. Like, there's no other way to get to them or for them to get to me. So I do miss it. But when I was doing Picture This, I got to draw them free of the four-panel constraint. And it was sort of like watching a dog get out of the backyard and just lose their mind. So that was really fun to see them. And I know I'm talking about them like they're alive. They kind of are to me, to see them move around in a way that wasn't confined to four panels.
So you missed your friends and then you freed your friends.
Yeah. I busted them out.
I know a young woman who's tremendously talented graphically and she wanted to do comic strips. What advice would you give to people who want to do comic strips these days?
I tell them, first of all, to get Ivan Brunetti's book, Cartooning Philosophy and Practice. It's the only cartooning book I've ever seen that really helps you make comics about what's important to you.
The name's Brunetti.
Brunetti, like a brunette, but Brunetti. Ivan Brunetti, he's a cartoonist. And it's just a really, really good book, and it skips all this other stuff. And I also think that there's no better time to be a cartoonist than right now because so many styles are accepted now. People understand that comics are kind of like music. You can make a song about anything. You can make a comic about anything. And so, and there are a lot, there's a wider variety of people doing comics now than ever before. And more importantly, there's a wider variety of people reading comics than ever read comics before.
But how do you get it to them if there's not such a great market for comics?
Well, I don't know that you can necessarily get it to them, but it's like saying, how do I get my bike ride to people after I took this great bike ride? It's like, maybe it's not something that's transferable, but it's something that's very good for you to do. Or singing a song, you know, I mean, that's the one thing I think that's hard for people to understand, that there's a reason to do this other than to be professional and to have accolades from I don't know, from whoever gives accolades. So
accolades on high.
Yeah, where are they? I have a friend who's a songwriter, and people were playing around, and somebody said to him, we played around and wrote a song, and somebody said to him, you should send that in. And he goes, where? I think it just came in. I mean, there's this idea that there's this place for this stuff. And that's what makes people stop and not do it. And I always, if I compare it to a bike ride, they get it. If you think you can only ride a bike if you can ride like Lance Armstrong, then there's no more bikes. So if you think of it as this thing that's actually good for you and good for the people around you because you're less evil after you do comic strips.
And not good for you like spinach or broccoli, probably, but
yeah, like good for you like spinach and broccoli.
Really?
Actually, yeah. No, and but tasting different.
Okay.
Yeah, but good for you exactly.
I mean, I do
that
like
way.
Spinach and broccoli, so but and I cook with it a lot, but
I think that there's a corollary between this stuff and our and I mean, I think that the I think of the arts or this thing that we call the arts, as the corollary to our immune system, that it has something to do with regulation of, in the way that our immune system or our autonomic nervous system regulates our body temperature and our fight against bacteria. I think the arts, or play, what they call it for little kids, has a similar function. Even though it's on organs that we can't necessarily see, like our mind, we can't see it, but you know, you can't actually get it removed.
So, how do you get a healthy immune system?
Well, you have to engage with it. I mean, you have to actually do it and mess around with it. And kids do that normally. And one of the things that's been interesting, because of now that there are fMRIs and people can kind of see what's going on in the brain when we're in different states, one of the most interesting things that I read was that the way the brain looks in an fMRI or EEG for a little kid when they're in deep play is very similar to what a brain looks like for an adult when they're in creative concentration. In other words, the entire brain is pretty much activated. And one of the things almost everybody knows around the world is that if a kid's not allowed to play, they go crazy. I mean, there's a tacit understanding between play and mental health. And if what's going on in deep play is very similar to what's going on in creative concentration for adults, then I would imagine that that also applies to adults. And what happens is, like, okay, we'll look at a kid again. If they're not allowed to play, but all I do is show them pictures of other kids playing Legos, it doesn't work. Or I show them watch DVD, this kid can play Lego. Or we'll go live. We'll sit, don't move, but you can watch this kid play Lego, but you can't play. It won't do the same thing. And for adults, that's where most of us are. We've given up on all this stuff, so we go watch people do it or listen to people do it. And then we just wish.
I'm speaking with Linda Berry, the author of the Ernie Pugh comic strip that ran for so many years. And she's doing this really cool thing these days. She's teaching creativity seminars, and she's written this incredible book, What It Is, about how you can take some exercises to get that immune system going, and also its memoir and its collage and its art, and its there's more wisdom in it than in almost any book I've read in the last 5 years. So it's great to have you here, Linda Berry, on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. So you celebrate play here.
Yeah.
Obviously. The mind is just a very funny little instrument, isn't it? I'm reminded of these people who are the opposite of children. They're very old. They have Alzheimer's. And sometimes they have barely spoken in months. And then they hear an old poem or an old fairy tale or an old song, and boom, something clicks on. So there's something deep in there that responds to play or ditties or little things that the memory stores that aren't, you know, facts and linear.
Well,
your whole approach is kind of nonlinear access to this imagination.
Well, it's a different part. It's actually a different part of the brain. I mean, if you think of your first phone number, can you remember your first phone number?
Oh, I know this is one of your exercises in your book, and I don't have that first phone number. I've got, you know, then the area code changed a couple times, went from 312 to 847, so I can get part of it.
Well, some people can remember it, and they remember it right away. And then if I ask them about their phone number from three phone numbers ago, you can almost feel the different part of your brain where you're searching for it. And now, if you can't remember your phone number from three phone numbers ago, you don't feel so bad. But when you can't remember your first phone number and I'm looking at you, you're just like touching your face and like, oh no, I forgot it. Like you forgot a friend, right?
Right. How'd you arrive at that exercise, by the way?
I was trying to figure out I'm very interested in spontaneous memory. And we experience it all the time. Whenever you're walking down the street and you smell this smell, and there's your Aunt Louise, she wore Chantilly, that same smell. Or there's your Uncle Louis's garage, you know, you smell this oil. And what happens is when that memory comes back, if we could freeze time, what's coming back is not a picture of Aunt Louise's kitchen. The kitchen itself is there, and you could actually turn around in it. Like if we could freeze that moment and I'd say, what's in front of you, what's behind you, you can actually turn around. So an image is kind of a place, or a spontaneous memory, I think of, is more of a place, the whole place that comes. And so I started to get interested in that, and I noticed that I tried to think of a fast way I could show people, and I remembered how people love to say their first phone number. Like when they say their first phone number, they all get kind of giddy after. Like it's sort of sweet, you know. They go, ooh. And So I found that, and then I started to get interested in this other kind of memory where we're trying. And those are two different things, spontaneous memory and then the memory where you're really trying.
So give me an example of how you access the trying memory.
Well, the trying memory would be just, I mean, that's the memory I'm less interested in. But it's that memory that when you're trying to remember the name of that guy in the movie, you know that guy with the hair. You know what I mean? When you're trying to remember that, in the it's like chasing a chicken. You can't get close to it. It just keeps the same distance. So what do people do when they're trying to remember something but it won't come to them? They do something else. You know, they just stop. And what's amazing about the back of the mind is, so you give up on remembering it, and then you're in line, you know, buying your National Enquirer, and all of a sudden you go, Victor Mature, Victor Mature. I mean, it's 3 days later, but you're still really excited. So what made the back of the mind decide to give it to you at that point? That's the stuff I'm really curious about. Like, why is it? It's our mind. So why is it that we can't remember something, or we can't get something out of our head, like a song stuck in our head?
Speaking with Linda Berry, so you make this connection between memory or spontaneous memory, and then what's the leap from recovering that spontaneous or recognizing that spontaneous memory and sparking imagination? Because you play those two things together.
Yeah, well, the thing is, if you can arrange to have a spontaneous memory, and you can, with a pen in your hand for a limited amount of time, what you end up doing is, for example, one of the exercises I give my students is to think of a car from when they were little, just a car. And you'll watch people, they'll get a certain look on their face, you see that they have it. You
67 have a, Mustang.
You have it, right? Yeah. So you're picturing it? So are you inside of the car or outside of the car as you're picturing it?
I was watching my dad drive it.
You're watching it? So you're inside the car?
No.
You're
exactly.
Watching him drive by?
Right.
So which part of the car is driving by?
Driving into the driveway.
He's driving into the driveway. Right. So which part of the car are you facing?
I'm facing the left front of the car.
The left front of the car. And is it day or night in this?
It's daytime.
Daytime. What season?
It's fall.
It's fall. If I was going to ask you what's directly in front of you, that's the car. So if you're going to turn your head and look to your left, what's there?
Well, then there's the house, and to the right's the basketball hoop.
Uh-huh. And what's to your left?
The garage.
Uh-huh. And behind you?
Is the front lawn.
How about around your feet?
I'm just on the driveway there.
You're on the driveway. Yeah. So that place is there, right? You can turn around and look in it. And I asked you, in that car, you weren't thinking about that car 3 minutes ago.
Right.
That place is fully there. So if you and I sat down and wrote, I would ask you a bunch of questions, almost like we were on the phone. Yeah, so what are some of the sounds you can hear? Yeah, so what's the air smell like? And if you write that down, it turns out you end up with a story. And what's a story? Well, a story is not just a thought. It's an actual – a thought doesn't come by itself. It's actually a place that can be transferred from one mind to the next. That's the stuff I'm interested in, very interested in.
Now, one of the things that you do is you do these writing exercises. So you tell your students – or whoever's in the seminar, I guess they're your students, subjects, patients, clients to have that pen in their hand. And one of the things, because I've done a little writing clinics too, is people want to stop. You know, they want to stop and reward themselves after they've written the first sentence or after they've drawn the first line, I suppose. And how do you get them not to do that?
You give them a short amount of time. So it's sort of like, all these things that we talk about when we talk about writing, like story structure and editing and character development, the only reason we can talk about them is because they already exist. We identify them. We don't make them by knowing about them. And so what happens is if you give somebody 7 minutes to tell a story, and all of us can do this. Like if we're talking on the phone to our friend and we think we have 5 minutes to go on about a coworker we both hate, you know, like it's delicious talking about that, right? And then suddenly you realize you only have 2 minutes to tell the story of how she spilled the Skittles again, you know, by your desk. You know how to edit that. Everybody does if you only have 2 more minutes. And you know from doing radio that that's exactly what you have to do. You know, so we're hardwired to fit stories into spaces. What people don't do is they don't give themselves a confined space to put that story in. So it just feels like they can go forever. So why not stop?
Mm-hmm. But also part of it is fear. Fear of the superego, fear of being judged negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like about what I've read about your seminars is that you don't do that. You don't get into a critique,
no.
Which is the death of so many writing classes. But what you do is you say good, good, or you just say, let's do another exercise.
Yeah, and I have really specific rules in the class. For example, you can't look at the person who's reading. Yeah, you have to actually draw while they're reading. Mm. So you're practicing basically listening to a story while moving your pen in your hand, which is what you need to do to be a writer.
And is part of that because you don't want the reader to get the negative feedback from people who may not be liking the reading?
There's a little bit of that, but it's more so that people in the room get too mixed up to keep track of who's read what. And so that the story actually becomes the thing instead of the hierarchy in the room. And we never talk about the work because in a weird way, just by hearing it together, the work starts to get stronger. Humans are pack animals, and we really do learn as a group, but not if we're sitting and talking about everything. Plus, I don't think it's anybody's business what they've just written. I mean, right. It's your business 2 days later, but after you've just written it, it's your business. You need to just put it away and not try to hurt it for 2 days.
And also, I mean, you just talk about, and you don't put it in these words, but just how constipating the self-lacerating question, is this any good or does this suck?
Yeah.
Just how paralyzing that is.
Well, what's sad is when that comes down, those are the only two questions left. And again, I get back so many of these problems or things I've been trying to figure out about the thing we call the arts. I figure it out when I go right back to childhood. And here's the big difference between a kid drawing and an adult drawing. When a kid's drawing on a piece of paper, the piece of paper is a place for an experience. When an adult is drawing, it's a thing that is either good or bad and either shows that, you know, how dare you draw because you can't draw. It's getting it so that it's a place for an experience again. If you can get that, then something can happen. And you don't have to keep the drawing. But this thing that happens when you're drawing or writing, it's a spontaneous gesture. That's the stuff that I find most interesting and what people seem to feel rewarded by.
I'm speaking with Linda Barry, famous for the Ernie Pooks comic strip. She's got this great book out called What It Is, and I gather that Picture This, another book, is quite similar to it. What It is part memoir, but really an oddly philosophical discussion about what is art and how do you make art and how do you access your imagination, even imaginations that may have been frozen for many years. It seems to me that you say everyone can do art. I mean, you say we are all an old can of pork and beans with a genie inside.
We are.
So how do you open the can?
Well, people are constantly opening the can, whether they know it or not. I mean, every time that you're sitting in a meeting and you doodle, you know, people give up on drawing usually fifth or sixth grade. Maybe you make it to 11 or 12 before you quit. But they still will doodle, and they have this one area of the page where it's okay to be free, right?
I love the celebration of doodling, which is in the book, too, that this is kind of the last province of freedom.
It's the little vestigial tail or the little vestigial monkey tail. So I ask people, they say they don't draw, and I say, well, is there a doodle that you draw over and over? Everybody has one. They go, oh, yeah, eyeballs or palm trees or stars. And so I ask them why. Why did they do it? Well, when you think about it, why do you do it? When do you do it? You do it when you're bored. You do it when you're stuck online with the, you know, waiting for the cable guy. And so why are you doing it then? And I think it's because it makes waiting more tolerable. How is it doing that? So, I mean, and that's sort of fascinating to me. And it's not like it makes it really more tolerable. I always say it's the difference between time feeling like a cheese grater or a Brillo pad. And the Brillo pad will give you a little more time. So I look at that, or if you watch people when they're trying to remember something, what they do is they'll do their hands like this. Oh, what was his name? So what do? They do a rhythm, and they make a singing sound. And then that seems to release a memory. So it's rhythm and singing. Something's going on there. So if you look at these places where it is in our lives, even down to peeling beer labels while somebody's really boring you with a story of their dream.
Oh, I do that all the time.
Yeah, but it's a very satisfying thing, peeling that beer label. So something's going on there. That's the stuff that I'm interested in, are these little places where it still hides.
Well, maybe that's where my hidden artist is. Though I keep telling myself I'm going to write more poems, but sometimes I do that. Tell me about the importance of the pen as opposed to the computer.
Well, there's some really interesting things about the hand and about handwriting that as it's being abandoned. I mean, for people my age, I'm 56, to find out that cursive isn't taught anymore is sort of shocking. And there is an assumption that we don't need it because we have this keyboard thing. Well, it turns out that there's all the difference in the world between making an A, which is drawing, And what's drawing? Drawing's motion. It's a repeated motion or a memorized motion than typing a letter to get an A, just in terms of your brain and where things are in terms of spatial relationships and also dexterity of the hands. And if you watch people who are trying to remember something or think of something, again, you'll see them use their hands. There have been all kinds of studies that have been done showing that if somebody's trying to explain a complicated problem they've solved, if they sit on their hands while they're trying to explain it, they have a harder time speaking. Mm. So there's some really interesting stuff about handwriting and speech and thinking. And one of the studies that I read is about a different part of the brain that's activated that has to do with speech. You and I are using it right now. It's the Broca's area. That has to do with that's sort of activated when you write by hand and not activated in the same way when you use a keyboard.
It's interesting. I'm speaking with Linda Berry. That some of these tips that you give people are so pre-industrial. I'm playing, walking, singing, writing with a pen with your hands. That is, you're tying in with something very eternal. I was going to say primitive, but it's not primitive.
No, they're the original digital devices. Our hands are the original digital devices. And everything, all this technology is basically an extension of these things. But I am concerned about the loss of complicated hand movement at an early age for kids now. I'm really concerned about it because I feel like our brains and our hands, particularly our thumbs and our tongues as well, all developed together. It wasn't like the brain was there and then grew some hands, or the hands was there and grew
but
a brain.
They're doing different complicated hand movements. They're doing the PlayStation stuff, and they're doing computer.
Yeah.
So they're using their hands,
they're using their hands in a different way.
They're
using their hands in a really sort of strange way. A friend of mine, this French woman, she said, you know, for centuries we could build a cathedral, we could make all these roads, all these things, but now we can hurt ourselves with a little mouse. And it's true, people getting repetitive hand, you know. So it's interesting, it's hand motion, but it's really primitive. I mean, I know that the technology itself is really advanced, but the motion we're doing is very primitive and
so
repetitive.
Other than writing for children, I suppose adults, what other hand things do you recommend?
Hula.
You're an old hula person.
I know, I'm an old hula dancer. And I always think that that actually had a huge influence on me because I moved my hands just, I was devoted. I took Hawaiian dancing for 6 years when I was a kid, went twice a week, and no one looked at me and said, you know, you look kind of like a girl Alfred E. Newman, and I don't think there's a hula job waiting for you. That was lucky. That was lucky for me because I did move a lot and I did move my hands a lot. But I think handwriting is plenty and doodling. I think it's plenty. And for those, you know, like for just to give you an example of how great handwriting is, if you've always wanted to do Tai Chi, I always have wanted to do Tai Chi, but I'm too lazy to memorize it. One day my husband said, why don't you do Type Chi and just move like your hands giantly, but do the alphabet. And it works. You can do giant A's and giant B's and look like you're doing Tai Chi.
You celebrate the alphabet, Linda Berry, also in this book, and you recommend people reciting the alphabet or writing the alphabet. What does that return you to? How does that make someone tap into creativity?
Well, again, it stimulates, it activates the brain in a different way than just pressing a button does, for the letter A, for example. But if you think about it, you know this combination, particularly people who can write cursive and print. It's any combination. If I just give you the word encyclopedia or onion or fantastic, you can write it. Now, what's going on there? That's pretty interesting because it's a memorized series of motions, right, that you can do in any combination. It's as complicated as playing the piano. And so I know that that is making the brain move in different ways, and I think my assumption is that when your brain is activated in different ways, my assumption is that's a good thing.
Speaking of Linda Berry, the comic strip maker and author of a book called What It Is, which I just read in the last day about creativity and part memoir, too. It's fascinating with the collages. I just want to talk for, we got 5 minutes left, mm-hmm. about the book a little bit. You've got all sorts of great images that you draw, and then there's some recurring ones, a lot of recurring ones, and one is Lincoln. Lincoln's in there a lot. Why Lincoln?
He's my historical honey. You know, it's funny because in a weird way, you won't know what your recurring images are until you make a whole bunch of them. So I didn't even notice there was so much Lincoln. There's lots and lots of Lincoln. There's squids that kept coming up.
Yeah, an octopus.
Yeah, an octopus. Rabbits come up.
Rabbits, birds.
And I don't know that you can ever say why. I mean, you can guess. After a couple drinks, you could really guess. But I don't know that you can actually put your finger on it. I just know that those are the creatures that that populate the back of my mind. You know.
Yeah, it's fun to see them over and again. And Lincoln, of course, we claim is a great progressive.
Yeah.
And then Blake. Blake's in there several times, too.
Yes. Yeah, he was probably the most open-minded person that I can think of. I mean, really open-minded, like open like the sky. And pretty pissed off, too.
Great poetry, too.
Yeah.
And you write about how important a couple books were when you were growing up. Grimm's Fairy Tales,
yes.
For instance.
Those fairy tales are still very important. And actually, there's a set of translations of Grimm's by this guy named Mannheim, the Mannheim translations, which are, as far as I've been able to find, the most faithful to the originals. And they really keep all the gnarly stuff in there. For example, you know the whole thing about kissing a frog and he turns into a prince? In the original one, actually the princess gets so tired of this frog that she throws him against the wall, and then he turns into the prince.
Ooh.
So I was reading it to my class because I love to read them fairy tales while they draw, and we all just went, what?
There's something in the book about the need to, you know, get in contact with the monsters of the imagination.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I love monsters. I've always loved monsters, and I feel like they've always been very, very helpful to me in understanding human nature. For example, vampires. Vampires have no reflection. You know, you've been around people who feel like vampires who can't see themselves at all.
And no antennas, right?
Yeah, just no. So nothing's personal. But I feel a lot more like the Wolfman, where I know I'm a monster and horrible, but I kind of can feel it coming on, and I can warn people to take cover.
What's the warning sign?
The warning sign is when I get when I really feel absolutely sure that I'm right. Do you know that absolute certainty? And everyone in the world suddenly seems like they're doing things wrong. That's usually a clue that something's amiss.
Absolute certainty is a scary thing.
It really is.
Something to be aware of.
I'm absolutely certain about that.
We only have a couple minutes left. If someone's listening to us, Linda Berry, talking today, and they want to take one of your seminars, what do they do?
Well, they should go to – I have a little Tumblr page. It's called thenearsightedmonkey.tumblr.com. And there are – I actually have made little video exercises that if you just scroll down, you can just try them. I just made some for my students and also people who are interested. So go there and just scroll down and try some of the videos and – I think it belongs to everybody. So I'm hopefully trying. I'm making these little videos, even though they're shot. You know, it's just me on my couch with my computer, leading these little writing exercises. But I'm hoping to get a bunch of them online just for people who want to do it.
They belong to everyone, like Jonas Salk's vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
I remember someone asked him, "How come you don't patent this and make money out of it?" He says, "It belongs to everyone. It's like the sun."
Yeah, it is like the sun. It is like the sun. It's just like the sun.
Yeah. Linda Berry's been my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. I do want to encourage everyone to go pick up this book. It's called What It Is. It's a big book, and it's filled with great pictures and terrific stories, but it gets closer to you know, how we imagine things and how we can access our imagination and what creativity is about. Than anything I've ever read before, and it's fun and it's non-judgmental, and I think you will enjoy it. Linda Berry, thanks so much for being my guest today. This was so much fun.
I am so happy that you asked me to come.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.